Okay, I'm gonna do it here.
This meeting is being recorded.
Okay, so we've been discussing.
You can finish off with the Sikhs muster if you need more things to talk about.
Now we'll just end early. We've been discussing this article by Broyden Wiener, and I was trying to point out a lot of issues along the way. We're up to their discussion of our sugya here on page 54. So they've been making the argument that the halacha generally doesn't have a robust theory of contracts. A lot of their proofs come from like non-contract based sugyas, which we saw, and Zioni pointed out last week, for example, in Davar Shlomo Liola, Davar Shena Bershusa discussion. They also seem to have an amorphous conception of what it means that the halacha is trying to preserve freedom of choice. Their main argument is that the halacha is reluctant to enforce contractual agreements because they think the halacha wants to preserve like the freedom of choice of workers, or just the free choice of workers, they keep saying. I wanted to argue that that's problematic because you might think that enforcing contracts gives you more free choice overall. Meaning the choice to contract and have these binding obligations and binding entitlements. We also pointed out that they seem to conflate the question of having an obligation to do something with the enforcement of the obligation. And you might think that enforcement is really what infringes on freedom, not having the obligation per se. But I want to take now a closer look at their discussion of our sugya, what they have here under the sale of labor and contract law. And I'll just make a few ha'aros here. So they say that the halacha doesn't have what they call a bilateral executory contract, meaning you can't have a... They think the halacha doesn't recognize contracts where each party has obligation towards the other one, in the sense that I'm bound to provide you with, let's say, surgical masks, and you're bound to pay me, you're bound to accept my delivery of them. They're going to argue that the halacha doesn't recognize that kind of bilateral executory agreement where each side still has to perform. And they're going to say the halacha only recognizes contracts as binding once there's partial performance from one party. So here's what they say. They say, in labor contract cases, as in cases of goods sales, we have a sweeping Talmudic renouncement of promissory enforcement. If an employer and laborer agree to a labor contract and then one of them backs out, the aggrieved party has no legal claim for damages. So first of all, that quote is like totally misleading. That quote is the Mishnah of Ein Lam Zel Zel Taromes, but of course the Gemara qualifies it as saying that that only applies in a case of B'dilo Holchu, B'dilo Zchilu Malacha, etc., etc. So it's misleading to quote this broad statement of the Mishnah when the Gemara itself provides so many qualifications of it. So then they say, analogous to what we saw in the sale of goods, the labor agreement from the Talmudic perspective is rather like a unilateral contract in common law. So the extent to which halacha enforces a contract, they want to argue, is in a unilateral, what they call a unilateral contract as opposed to a bilateral one, where one side has already performed. But absent performance from one side, they're going to think that there's no halachic enforcement. So here's what they say. Once an employee fully performs his contracted work, the employer is in debt for the full contracted service, for the full contracted wages. That's a very limited conception of contract. It means once one party provides the service, there's a duty to pay. Thus, the promises alone create no obligations, but performance by one particular party will obligate the other. So I think that's false, right? They think that like it's all going to boil down to some sort of quantum merit. You're paying for performance. They think that's the only valid view of halachic contracts. We saw maybe that's a possibility. Maybe there's a possibility of viewing every contract as a kind of a yored with just a way of a fixed evaluation of the price of the work. But that's clearly not the only way. So, as I point out here in my comment, I think there are actually two separate dinim here. We saw two different themes in the Rishonim, two different lines of thought. One thought said that, yeah, contracts are really just quantum merit with compensation for performance, which is how Broyd and Wiener are looking at it. But we also saw tons of views that say that there's a contractual Kinyon basis, right? Once there's a Kinyon that's performed, whether that Kinyon is some Maisa Kinyon, like Shtar and Chazaka, or whether that Kinyon is through Haschalas HaMelacha, it's the Kinyon which makes the bilateral obligations enforceable and binding. So I don't think it's true to say that all contractual obligations are grounded in performance. If anything, the halacha just uses performance in our sugya as a proxy for there being some sort of maisa kinyan through Haschalas HaMelacha. So I think this is totally inaccurate. Anybody have thoughts on this? Adam.
When you bring up the issue of those who are going via the Kenyan route, even this could be, go according to the Kenyan route if you're talking about Haschalas HaMelacha.
Absolutely, but they're not thinking of it in terms of, they're not thinking of Haschalas HaMelacha as a Kenyan, as a Kenyan meaning making the stuff binding. They're thinking of Haschalas HaMelacha as a duty to compensate for performance, right? Once an employee fully performs his contracted work, the employer is in debt for the full contracted wages. Notice
that's fully.
Yeah, Haschalas HaMelacha doesn't require full performance. It just means that there's some performance which triggers the obligation, right? See, they say promises alone create no obligations. I think that's false. A promise through a Maisa Kinyan would create obligations. A promise consummated by Haschalas HaMelacha would create a binding obligation to finish and pay for that finish. For the rest of the work.
The promise, by definition, does not involve a kinyan.
So I don't know if that's true. I mean, I think then the answer is that the halacha here just requires the kinyan to be consummated, that requires the promise to be consummated by a kinyan.
But as he's been talking about promise previously, promise is truly something that's just a verbal.
Yeah, so I don't think that's fair, right? Because even in contract law, they're viewing contracts as binding promises. That requires some sort of consideration, which is more than a promise, right? So they can't mean mere promises. They mean contracts as a form of binding promises. In my view, the Maisa Kinyan would be a way of making the promise binding. Got it? Yeah, but it's a good comment, but I don't think that's what they have in mind here. Yoni.
I agree with you. I would add something like the line right before it, where you say that it's rather like a one-way, a unilateral contract.
Yeah.
I guess a one-way, it says bilateral. And I think that like goes back to the same point. Like, I'm not sure Allah views contracts as unilateral. Like, there are responsibilities. It's not just that there's a promise to pay, it's also there are certain responsibilities that come with it the employer has to pay. The whole concept of like the minhagim of like a Valtala and Minhagim of like whether it's Lahashim or Lahariv and they have to pay for their food potentially and all those other like requirements, like presume that there's much more than just a unilateral agreement where the employee is going to give you something and get compensation.
100%.
There's a lot more to it.
100%. 100%. And to, you know, to bolster that point, remember, here's my, you can see my comments here, right? Give me a thumbs up. You see the note that I
can see him here.
What?
Yeah, I can see him on your screen.
Yeah, okay, good. Yeah, I updated my comments, so the one I sent out is not fully updated. But if you can see them on my screen, you see the comment that I opened up on my screen, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So he says, remember the views that whole... my comment is, remember that Haschalas HaMelacha, the poel gets the full value of the contract, less the cost of completion. It's not really quantum merit necessarily, right? This is the best evidence for this was the tour shita that if the cost of labor goes down, the poel gets a windfall, right? The poel gets the full contract value minus the minimal cost of completion. So, yeah. Okay. Can you guys hear me, or is the background noise too loud?
There is a lot of noise.
Yeah.
Maybe neighbors.
Yeah, they just came out. Maybe
family,
give me...
Family 212 going?
Yeah, maybe...
You could try sneezing on them.
Yeah. Get arrested for domestic terrorism. You know. Give me 1 second.
recording has stopped.
All right, I'm not going to do this one. I don't know why it's so bad.
This meeting is being recorded.
Okay, so, Yeah, okay, Yoni, you were in the middle of talking, or was I in the middle of talking?
Well, I made my point. I think you were saying something else.
Okay, fine. So, yes, I was just reinforcing your point over here with the observation that Haskalah Samalafa triggers more than just quantum meroweth compensation for the performance that was begun. It triggers obligations for the whole contract. And as Yoni, as you're pointing out, it also triggers different kinds of obligations, like maybe Yomot Titein Scharo and things like that, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yeah, okay, good. So I think their characterization here is problematic. Good. Later on in the article, so they proceed to say that the Talmud preserves restitutionary interests. So an employer can get his money back, and the employee who has partially performed is entitled to partial compensation. Okay? This is true. This is what they say is analogous to quantum meroweth in common law. If you performed, you're going to... If you performed, you're going to get compensated for the performance that you did. Okay? So they say the following. Tell me if you think this characterization is correct. Talmudic authorities engage in a fairly sophisticated debate on the issue and generally give the party not in default the choice between pro rata contract price and the contract price less the cost of completion as possible standards for recovery. Do you think that's right? Is this an accurate description of Yado Alha Yona?
Can you put your cursor over that line?
What do you guys think?
I think minimally it's confusing. I don't recall that we had cases where it was presented as a choice, where the whoever's Yedo Al Yona can choose whether they want one or the other. It seems like it was prescribed.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. We've never seen, in other sugyas, the Gemara presents Yedo Al Yona as an option to choose between two different metrics of compensation. Like in Yored, the Gemara presents Yedo Al Yona as giving one party the choice to choose what kind of compensation they want. But not in our sugya. In our sugya, Yedo Al Yona meant that the worker doesn't have to suffer any penalty for breaching, right? So it either means, according to some Rishonim say it means, the worker will always recover the contract price prorated to the amount of work that he did. That's how some Rishonim read it. Other Rishonim read it to say, like the tour, that it means you get the full value of the contract less the cheaper cost of completion. So actually, it's never proposed. Nobody in our sugya holds, as Yair very nicely said, no one in our sugya holds that it's a choice. Rather, it means that the poel gets like a good deal despite his breach, right? Yoni raised his hand.
I mean, this is a while ago, I feel like, already, but weren't there some Rishonim that said you get the greater of the two? And then whichever of the two is bigger? Isn't that like the simplest reading Yedo Al Yona?
I guess it's true for the tour. I think he would get the greater of... Well, I don't know. I guess maybe the tour who says you get contract price less the cost of completion will think that the poel gets that. I guess, I mean, whichever one of these is greater as determined by... You're saying for the tour shita.
I don't remember, honestly, which shita. I feel like there's got to be some shita that believe that's the greater of the two. I seem to feel like the most simplest reading of Yadol Yono.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, standard thing. If Yadol Yono is comparable then to, like, the Uman who messes up, and therefore you get, like, either Shvach Kli or you get the... Or yeah. You get the chef of the, or you get the schar, right? You get the less of the two, or you get the greater of the two.
Yeah. It's interesting. I need to think about that a little more. Because I guess that would be true for the tour shita, but for the shach, I mean, for most Rishonim, they think that the poel is just stuck with getting quantum meruit for the amount of work that he did, right? Yad poel al yona means that he's not penalized; he doesn't have to sacrifice the prorated amount. The tour had the chiddush to say that the poel gets the full value of the contract less the costs of completion. That's what he could get. But he'll never get less than the quantum meruit amount. So I don't know if it's really right to phrase it as a choice as opposed to a different metric. But I hear that you could justify this, at least according to the shita of the tour. But it's definitely not the standard view. The standard view is that the poelim get quantum meruit for what they did. Okay. I also want to point out here, Yoni, you still have a hand, or that was your old hand?
Of the old one.
Okay. Yakir, do you have thoughts on this?
Yeah, I agree with what you said. I think that this sounds accurate according to the tour.
Okay.
On the Poel side. And on the Balabaya side, it seems fine.
Okay. That's fair. The other problem I would raise here is that this is only true for a Poel. Right? They generally give the party not in default the choice between pro rata contract price and the contract price less the cost of completion. No, I take this back. He's saying they give the party not in default, meaning the party that was not chozer.
Meaning the poel gets to choose with chazar to balabai. That's like the...
Is that true, though?
The balabai doesn't get to choose with chazar to poel.
Right. Right. Right, so Yoni, your point, Yakir and Yoni's point is true if we were saying that the halacha gives the poel, who's chozer, the right to choose between the contract price less cost of completion or a quantum meruit. I don't think it's true ever that the halacha gives the party not in default this ability to choose, right? I thought, for example, if it's a kablan who's chozer, the balabayis just pays the contract less the cost of completion. It's never quantum meruit, no?
Well, it would be, presumably it would be if that were lower, right?
Uh-huh. Meaning he'll never have to pay more than what the worker actually did.
Right.
Okay, so you're saying maybe it is technically accurate. I need to think about that more then. Okay. Fine. Interestingly, the Talmud is emphatic that a laborer paid by the hour or by any unit of time as opposed to a job contractor is entitled to recover pro rata contract price for partial performance, even where the laborer defaults, right? So I think that's generally true, right? They have this distinction here between Poel and a Kablan and Yad Poel al Yona. I just want to point out that maybe, I know this is not their burden over here, but it's not obvious that this is the right way to define a Poel. They said a laborer paid by the hour is going to be different. We saw, like in the Sma and in other Achronim, who thought that what makes a poel is the fact that he's constantly under the command of his employer, right? Eino rashai lehisbatel. He doesn't have the right to waste time. He has to finish the job in a certain amount of time. It's a little controversial to define a POEL by just the mere fact that he's paid by the hour. Although fine, maybe there are some post-game who view it that way. And in a Hanami, this is not really the thrust of their article. But I just wanted to flag that observation. Okay. Good. They say, they quote Ki Libanei Yisrael Avadim Velo Avadim LaAvadim. So they say, as much as any statement, this is a statement of core values and not just of contract law. So I'm not so sure about this, because poskim do seem to limit Ki Libanei Yisrael Avadim Velo Avadim LaAvadim, you know, to a case where there's no kinyan. Maybe it's like it could be overridden, doesn't apply in a lot of cases. So I'm not disagreeing with what they're saying here, but I think they're definitely pumping Ki Libanei Yisrael Avadim and stretching it as much as they can. Yeah, you have a hand?
Yeah, I mean, I just want to make sure I'm not missing something. In the last line of this paragraph that's on the screen now, note the Talmudic quantum merit is available even for the defaulting employee, although the employer has the upper hand in choosing a standard. Maybe I'm missing, isn't it explicit in the sugya that the poel is the Adawal Aliona?
Yeah, there's a note that Talmudic quantum merit is available even for the defaulting party.
I just want to make sure I'm not missing something in that formulation, but...
So what do you want to say?
They just make the claim that the balabayas is yedawal al yona in a case where a poel is chozer, which is one of the things that we know for sure is not the case.
Right. Note that Talmudic quantum error is available even for the defaulting...
Unless they mean have the upper hand in some non-Talmudic sense.
That would be weird, right? Right, so you're saying that...
I just don't know why you'd put it in quotation marks if that's what you meant.
Right, right. Quantum merit is available even for the defaulting party, although the employer has the upper hand in choosing a standard. Yeah, it's pretty confusing. Right, and you're saying it's probably not true, because a poel has... If it's a poel, then he has yadol yona, right? I guess they just means that a kabla... I guess they mean that there's entitlement to some compensation. Yakir, you wanted to say something?
Hey, it's true if it's a kabla and if it's true for a bidosa, right?
It could be that I guess they're thinking the defaulting party for a defaulting employee.
It might be that they're talking about a kabla.
And they'll get some compensation. Yeah, I'm not sure. It doesn't really help much. It doesn't illuminate anything. Okay. And then here in this last statement, so again, they say that, recall that labor contracts are comparable to unilateral contracts under Talmudic law. So again, I think this is the same problem we encountered earlier. It's not true. They are again assuming that partial performance is the issue, not kinyan. Once you recognize that kinyan could create a labor contract with binding obligations, it's not true that Talmudic contracts are like unilateral contracts. Okay, now we get into more of the substantive issues and problems with their article. So here they say about reliant interest for the employee. Okay, so this means if the employer backs out, okay, so the employee can at least recover his reliance interest. So here's the quote. The employer must pay for any wages which have been lost as a result of his making and then breaking the work agreement. These are reliance damages. The laborer is compensated for wages he could have made by accepting a different job, an opportunity which is now no longer available to him because of the reliance on his employer's offer. So this we're familiar with, right? This we know, this is the din, that if the poalim were able to have found melacha elsewhere, and the balabayas is chozer, he's chayiv to pay them that amount, okay? They say this is not explicit in the Talmud, but it's introduced as well-grounded in Talmudic tort principles by early Talmudic commentaries, okay? So do you have thoughts on this? Do you have thoughts on this idea of chazara de balabayas triggering nezikin obligations towards the poel? It's introduced as well. So he's saying it's not contractual. It's based in tort principles. That if the balabayas is chozer, he's going to have to pay mitam nezek for what the poelim could have made elsewhere. Anybody have a...
it's like kind of true. It's and then we saw like the this is like the standard post vote view, and then like the Shulchan Aruch sent to Paskin based on it, and then we saw like a whole discussion like the Nosei Kalim, like how exactly to understand it. Is it fully nezek? Is it not fully nezek? Like, does garmi apply here? Does it not fully apply? Is it like a takanas hachamim that's like garmi?
Exactly. You know? I don't think this statement is problematic in and of itself. Certainly the Shita of Tosfos and the Shulchan Aruch seems to run with it. The only issue is that the Ktsos is very upset by this reading. Remember, the Ktsos thought that this would all amount to Grumma and Mevatel Kiso Shel Chavero, and so he thought that there's no way to trigger damages under a theory of Nezek. So he was inclined to read this all as quasi-contract principles, right? It's Davar HaAved from the Balabayas to the Poel. So the point I just want to make here is that they'd say it's well-grounded in Talmudic Torah principles. The Ktsos's point is that it can't be grounded in Talmudic Torah principles. Davar Aved has to be some like quasi-estoppel principle within contract law because it's not consistent with the general Talmudic principles of Torah. But I agree, Yoni, that it's fair for them to interpret it this way, even though there are some achronim, prominent achronim, who disagree with it. Anybody else have thoughts on this?
But most of them don't. I'm saying most don't agree with Ksod. Like, without the Nesivo thinks that based on this must be like a the kind of chachamim that's just like a garmi law applies here. The sma like stop like pasha the sma just like understands shacharis kapashdut as garmi. So
right. Well, I would say the Nesivos is not clear. The Nesivos, he thought it was a special takana. Maybe the Nesivos thought it wasn't mitam garmi directly, right?
It sounded like they kind of was to make garmi applicable. But we can go back to it.
Yeah. Okay. Notice again, they say here the Talmudic authority's view reliance is a pure tort action. So I'll just say again, that's consistent with Tosos' view and maybe the way some Achronim understand the Shulchan Aruch. I think the Shulchan Aruch itself used the formulation of Davar HaAved, I think, which the Ktsos took to mean that it's not mitam garmi for the reasons we mentioned earlier. So really just the same point. Here you can see I wrote it out in this comment. I'll circulate this newer version of my comments so that you all have copies. All right, here we go. Okay.
Sorry, are you still sharing your screen? Because I'm frozen on a page on mine.
Oh, maybe you haven't been computer. Seeing my screen?
I've been seeing it frozen. Oh, there we go. That's better. Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry, guys.
Oh, yeah. Now I see it, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, guys. I stopped the sharing, I think, when I moved. I thought that I hit the wrong button. I think that was the stop. I thought that was the stop recording, but it was the stop sharing. Okay. Okay, now you... Yeah, I'm sorry. So... Okay. But you get the point. Here's the thing I was reading. It's introduced as well-grounded in Talmudic tort principles by early Talmudic commentaries. That's what I was taking issue with. You can see here. This is somewhat controversial for the Ktsos' reasons. And they make the same point. The Talmudic authority's reliance is a pure tort action. And again, I think that's problematic, right? It's not clear that it's a pure tort action. Some speak of it as Davar HaAved, which can still be a contract remedy. I recall that the Ktsos thought this is too weak to constitute Nezek even under Garmi. But again, I think Yoni's right to say that Broid's right, that... there's some general truth to what they're saying. Notice in the last sentence here, what they say, in a similar case, common law would hold the employer to his promise and award full contract rate damages. So they're thinking that a proof that the halacha here is treating this as a principle of tort and not as contract is the fact that the remedy is the reliance damages, meaning what the poelim would have made under a different agreement had they been hired by somebody else, not to be paid out for what they would have made under this agreement, right? So in the common law would have given full contract rate damage, expectancy remedies, whereas the halacha here is only giving reliance damages. So I think that shows that the halacha is tort-based and not contract-based. I think that observation is right. Except that I would say that it's very possible, here, I'll open my comment for you to see, except that I think it's possible to say that if the mechayiv here is really Davar Ha'aved and not Garmi, then this could be a special kind of tort damages, like an estoppel that is here as like a quasi-contract principle. It's not grounded in, as they say, the pure principle of tort. Right? See, in their article, they say Talmudic authorities view reliance as a pure tort action. I think that's not necessarily the case. It's not a pure tort action, because it would only be grama. It's a special, as Yoni said from the Nesivis, it's a special takana or a special principle within contracts that can trigger tort-like damages. So here's one methodological criticism that I think might be warranted. You could see Broyd and Wiener are thinking in general law categories and imposing that framework on the halacha, whereas they really ought to be generating the framework out of the halachic concepts. So they're thinking just in terms of how the common law works. They're saying the common law, if it was a principle of contract, would award expectancy damages. The fact that the halacha does not award expectancy damages shows that the liability is tort liability and not contract liability. I would push back a little bit and say it's an open question whether the halachic theory of contracts will lean into expectancy damages or only award reliance damages, right? So we shouldn't be too wedded to the common law framework in deciding what the halachic principles are. And their illicit move is to say, in common law, contract always goes with expectancy, and if the halacha doesn't award expectancy, it's got to be tort. My response is that, well, you know, maybe some halachic principles of contract damages will not award expectancy, but still be contract remedies and not tort remedies. So that's just a broader methodological observation about how they're going forward with their argument here. Okay, anybody have thoughts before we move into the next section? Yoni, you have a thought?
Nope.
Okay. Yakir, you're good? Okay. Yair, you're good?
Yep.
Okay, Adam?
Yep, making a great strides in the field of quantum computing.
Okay, good. So the next section of the article discusses the reliance interest of the employer. So they want to say, when could the employer recover his damages? And they say that the Talmud is rather explicit on the point that the employer is not generally entitled to recover such damages from the employee. So the idea is if the cost of labor goes up and it costs him more to hire new workers, he generally can't recover. I just thought that they should have distinguished here between a poel and a kablon, because this is true for a poel. In a kablon case, we saw some poskim who thought that the Baal HaBayis could impose his cost of hiring new workers on the poelim. They talk about the exception of Davar HaAved, where you have the remedies of Sochar Alein. But I thought that they really should have distinguished here between a poel and a kablon, because a poel, it's true, has the right to be chozer without any penalty. But a kablon definitely gets yadol atachtona, and on some views, he even is liable for the cost of completion. Remember, the Rekiv Eger said that we view the new workers as their shliach to finish the job. So I think they really have an obligation here to distinguish between these two different kinds of workers. Yeah. Okay. I think they're... Yoni has a hand.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, not only that, but I think specifically with a quote from Mitzvah 76b, he's effectively saying that we paskin, in that quote, he's saying we're paskin like Arbidosa, that you're getting only the cost of completion standard, contract price less the cost of completion standard, which is Yadol effectively al ha'achtona. Right, even though he seems to be dealing with the stam poel.
If the employee claims restitution, this is the sentence you're reading? Then the employer can essentially cover his reliance by using the contract price less the cost of completion. standard to calculate the employee's recovery. Yeah. So this is about a Davar HaAved? It's either Davar HaAved, it can't be, because he talks about Davar HaAved later on.
Oh, this is Stam.
Right.
If this is just defaulting employees.
Right.
If the employee... He's saying defaulting employees, we pass in the Grubby Dosa, but we don't pass in Grubby Dosa. We only pass in Grubby Dosa for Koblenz.
You're talking about a goblin.
I mean,
but what? The only time he makes a comment about a pole and a goblin being different, I think he's seeing the pole as the exception, not the rule. Right? That was earlier in the in the previous page.
So you're saying the standard.
So I suspect he might be referring to a goblin in this entire article.
But then, why do they talk about? They say the Talmud makes an exception.
That's really weird. It's really weird that the whole article is talking about a kavlun, not a poa. If the whole article is basing itself on the principle of kili b'deis halav adim, which applies specifically to poa, not kavlun.
Also, I want to point out the Talmud does not make an exception for cases where the contracted work is time. Does make an exception for cases where the contracted work is davar aved. Remember, we saw most Rishonim thought that the real significance of davar aved is for a poa, right? Because it undermines the zchus chazar of kili b'deis halav adim. For Rabbi Dosa, there's very little difference between Yad Pol al Tachtona and Davar Yad Kablan. Right, for a Kablan, there's almost it's not clear that there's any difference between Davar HaAved and non Davar HaAved.
What do you mean? So Harlein and Matan.
But I thought Rabbi Kivager thought that was true also for a Kablan, right? Because he has a duty to finish the job. Right, so I don't think it's true that I thought the standard view is that Sochalei Nematan is available for a Kablan because they have that same chiv to see the job through to completion. The chiddush of Davar HaAved is that it undermines the Poel's special zchus chazara. Yakir, you wanted to make a comment?
I don't know. I'm not remembering which of Kivager you're talking about, but also I'm not sure that that's generally true. I'm not sure that's right.
No. What do you think is right then? What's the remedy for Kablan?
And that it's like Ridoso. Yadol Tachtona, yeah.
Meaning, whereas a Poel has the, or whereas a Poel or a Kablan typically has the right to back out and just pay the damages, Sokolay Namatan says, no, let's try to get him to keep doing the job, which would be inappropriate according to, in a non Rahavid case.
Yeah. I don't know. I thought we saw Shitos by, you want me to pull up the Marmakomos on Kablan now, or you want me to email it out afterwards?
Maybe we should finish this discussion, and then if we have time.
Okay, I think this is. I agree with Yoni here. It would be very peculiar if all of this was limited to a Kablan. And I think the standard view is that Davar HaAved is really an exception within Poalim. There's really not much of a difference when it comes to a Kablan between a Davar HaAved and non-Davar HaAved. But we could look more into that. Good. Notice that they leave out, notice that when they talk about Davar HaAved here, they say when the Talmud grants even these remedies of Sochar Leinu Matan, they're limited, right? They leave out, however, the two remedies that we discussed here, Kfiyah being the most important, right? We saw some Achronim who say that you could be Kofa the workers to finish in a Davar HaAved. We saw that in the Marit and in the Shaar Ephraim. They don't mention that at all, right? So they think that even in Davar HaAved, the remedies are super limited. Notice here also, when they talk about Socher Aleyen, he says, they may hire other workers and recover his reliance, the actual cost of completion, less the contract price. Do you think that's an accurate description of Socher Aleyen?
I mean, it omits mention of the the possibility of mem or nun, whatever that means.
That's true, yes.
Not insignificant possibility.
And what else is it? What else does it omit?
I'm trying to, I'm doing the calculation in my head.
It omits like the whole discussion, like that Rashi tour, Rush discussion we had.
They're just assuming
right about whether or not you can also be soaker like money from them already that you already paid.
Yeah, they're assuming here almost like the Rashi view or the limited view that the Poalim can never go into the negative for Davar Avid, right? The contract, the actual cost less the contract price. I'm reading that right. Do you think they meant to say here the contract price? Meaning, what are they trying to say here? In the way the Shulchan Aruch, the way most Rishonim Paskin, is that the Baal HaBayis can recover up to kefel scharan, right? Up to double the value of the contract of the Poalim. That's how much he could recover in Sochar Alein. So he could recover his costs up to the full value of the contract that he gave the workers. Some say at kefel scharan, right? Up to double. And so what are they saying here? He may hire other, recover his reliance, the actual cost of completion less the contract price. Shouldn't it really be they could recover up to the full value of the contract for their reliance damages? Shouldn't that be the right way to put it?
That's within Rashi, I think.
Well?
That's just within Rashi, though.
Even and within Rashi.
Totally lose up to the value of...
Yeah, even, or if you want to take the Rambam, ad kefel scharan, but I'm saying either way, I don't think this formulation of the actual cost of completion less the contract price is accurate. Right? Yoni, do you have sense on this?
Yeah, I'm with you. I think he's wrong. I don't know anyone who thinks, even Rashi, I don't think says exactly this.
Yeah.
This is like a real simplification of it. And I don't think, this is not Shulchan Aruch, but yeah, I'm not sure where he gets this.
Yeah.
I'm with you.
Yeah. Okay. Then they say, general relief for reliance damages by the employer does not seem possible under Talmudic law. So they'd say that they recognize that Davar HaAved is an exception here, right? That in Davar HaAved, there is going to be tashlume nezikin bidieved for the damages that the workers caused you by their breach, right? They say that in the flax case where property of the employer is literally at stake, tort doctrine is applicable, thereby protecting the employer. Where property is not at stake and the employer blah, 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 the Talmudic response is that basically the employer can't recover his damages. So the point that I want to make here is just that I don't think this is true to formulate this as general relief for reliance damages does not seem possible, because generally they will be able to recover anything that's a Davar HaAved so long as there's monetary loss. So if anything, I would say that whenever they're going to suffer a monetary loss, they are able to recover that. It's only in those cases where they're not losing anything by waiting that they're not entitled to recover under a theory of Nezek. So put differently, they make it seem as if relief mitam Nezek under a Davar HaAved is the exception to the rule. But remember when we defined and we looked through the whole sugya of Davar HaAved, Davar HaAved seemed to be very broad, right? The postmen were really liberal in defining things as Davar HaAved. Remember even that Baal HaBayis who was not able to cook his own food, right, his shifcha leaving the home is considered a Davar HaAved. So I would say, given the broad definition of Davar HaAved, general reliance damages would be recoverable, given that liberal interpretation of Devaravid. Yoni?
Yeah, I just have like a small comment, which is that in he makes a point that says that this is like the fourth line. In the middle, he says that a number of Talmudic authorities, he says that specifically when this applies to Devaravid, it's where the employer's property has been knowingly jeopardized by the workers.
Yeah.
So I just thought that was interesting because he's like appealing to that Choshen we saw.
Yeah.
About whether or not the employees had to know about Devaravid.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So where does the knowingly come from? So I think Yoni's right to say here that the workers, in order to be chayev for Devar HaAved, would have to have known that this they were being hired for a Devar HaAved or that they were jeopardizing it, right? Why do you think that's problematic that he says this? You could see my note. So, the Pisrei Choshen, Yoni, you see my note?
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I remember we had this discussion about the Pisrei Choshen, whether you have to make this argument.
Well, and the Pisrei Choshen was only saying that a condition of the Poalim becoming liable is... the Pisrei Choshen was saying a necessary condition of the Poalim becoming liable on the theory of Arev, that they're mischayev themselves midas, is that they know they're being hired for Devar HaAved, because otherwise how do you know that they're mischayev themselves midas? They would have had to have known that they were being hired for this kind of irreparable loss case, right? If they don't know this, then there's no basis to hold them liable. Here, they're talking about relief under tort doctrine, the Hagos Ashri and the Trumas HaDeshen, who said that Bidiyevet and Devar HaAved, if you suffer Nezek, you could collect, and they impose this condition of knowingly, which nobody requires under Nezek, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah. Okay, good. Okay. Good. Let's move on to the next section. Partial performance. So as I pointed out earlier, they think this is like the except. They say, oh, here's another weird exception to the rule. And you can notice the whole structure of the paper here, in addition to leaving out some explicit shitos, like, for example, in addition to leaving out the shitos that there could be kfiya to compel a kablan or a poel and a devar HaAved to complete performance, they also spin a lot of the rules as quirky exceptions. So like one example is this last case where they say, recovering damages mitam devar HaAved is a quirky exception to the rule. It doesn't usually apply. Generally, you won't be able to recover damages. Then they also say partial performance. They say if the poel already began working, if there was haschalas malacha, the employee is entitled to damages for his lost wages. Okay? Here, however, an expectancy measure is used, right? They're being paid for the work they were supposed to do, not for the alternative hiring possibilities they could have gotten. Regardless of whether the employee had any other opportunities at the contract time, he's entitled to his contract salary, okay? And so obviously this is a huge problem for their theory because here it's clearly a kind of contractual damages. It's the expectancy of what they would have earned. And so the halacha here is upholding a contractual agreement as normatively binding on the worker. He has a duty to perform, and the halacha is holding him to account. Sorry, the balabayas who hired him has a duty to allow him to perform and pay him, and the halacha is holding him to account. So the halacha is enforcing what seems to be a bilateral executory contract, right? So how do they deal with this? How do they explain this? So I want to point out also that this is not just an exceptional case of partial performance. This is anytime there's a Kenyan. Anytime there's a real Kenyan, not just through Haschalas HaMalacha, but even through a Maisa Kenyan, then there's a real contract that was executed, and the Halacha thinks that both parties are obligated. Right? The Baal HaBayis is obligated to pay, the worker is obligated to perform. So I think this case is not the exception. This case is the rule. They say, oh, this last rule is puzzling. It's uncharacteristically the Talmud enforces a partially executory bargain and awards expectancy damages. I would say that this is the standard case where you have a binding contract. The other cases are just cases where you fail to have a binding contract because there was no Kenyan or whatnot. So I think they're wrong to spin this as the exceptional case when in fact this is the case that's the rule. So how do they deal with this? So here's what they say. Let's make sure this is... Yeah. Their answer is this. One might also theorize that the rule simply reflects the truth that in reality, an employer who backs out after his employee has begun has quite probably caused his employee reliance damages. Okay? In other words, the partial performance rule might be viewed as simply a presumption at law that the aggrieved employee relied on the promise of wages to forgo other job opportunities. Recovery of promised wages after partial performance would then, in principle, be a tort-based reliance recovery, similar to the reliance recovery discussed earlier. So what's their move to make sense of what they see as the one exception to the halacha not upholding contracts? How do they make sense of it?
Perfect.
Yeah, exactly. They say, it must be that the basis of liability here is really tort-based. And just there's a presumption that the tort-based remedy is going to be at the same metric, the same measure as the contract-based remedy, because there's just a presumption that, the worker would have found similar work at a similar rate. And so we'll just like assume that they lost the same amount elsewhere where they would have made here. So that seems very problematic, because suddenly they're hanging their hat on a Shitas Yachid, Shitas Tosvos, which is explicitly rejected by the Shulchan Aruch. Remember, the Shulchan Aruch, it's against the Ramban, it's rejected by the Shulchan Aruch. Remember, the Shulchan Aruch said that if there's no Haskalah Samalacha or no Maisa Kinyan, then you always look to see what the Poalim could have made elsewhere. When there's a Maisa Kinyan or Haskalah Samalacha, it doesn't matter what they could have made elsewhere. So it's just it's disingenuous to suddenly say that, in the case of Haskalah HaMalacha, we're just going to assume that they could have made the same amount elsewhere, but when there's no Haskalah HaMalacha, we're not going to assume that. Right? Why should we have different presumptions about what the alternative hiring opportunities would have been between a case of Haskalah HaMalacha and no Haskalah HaMalacha? If they're both tort-based principles, we should look and litigate as to what the alternative employment opportunities were in each case. So they get stuck here with what they call an exception to the rule, where the halacha seems to be upholding contracts. They problematically refer this as a unilateral executory bargain, when in my view it's really a bilateral executory bargain. And they interpret it away as an exception that's really grounded in tort-based principles. I think once you realize their mistakes, you see this is actually the halachic rule, not the halachic exception. This is the case of where you finally have a valid contract. Once you have a valid contract, there's going to be an expectancy measure of damages because the halacha views there as being some normative right that was transferred through the contractual agreement, which is fully enforceable under halacha. So I think what they try to shoehorn in here as a last small exception to consider is actually the halacha's statement on what contracts look like. Okay, anybody have thoughts on this?
I guess I'm just trying to figure out if, like, what is being attempted in this piece. Like, surely it's not attempting to provide a comprehensive view of the sugyas. That we've demonstrated pretty clearly. So is it trying to present the way Dayanim on a contemporary Beit Din would actually view these things? Is it trying to present a Talmudic approach, what we think that, like, the Pashtus of the Gemara might think? I'm just a little bit lost about that.
So, yeah, you read the article, right?
Did.
Right, so isn't it the burden of the author to tell you what he's trying to do?
Oh, I'm not defending the article on that basis. I'm walking in with the presumption that, you know, if I understood the framework properly, more of this would make sense, and that intelligent people don't make the kinds of errors that we're observing so frequently without some kind of explanation. Maybe that's an overly generous assumption.
Yeah, I think it's overly generous. I think, look, it's a hard sigya. It takes a lot of work to flesh out the different issues. And this is just, I think it's sloppy on its analysis of the sigya. It's sloppy in how it conceptualizes the primacy of what constitutes the foreground of the halachic theory of contracts and what's just like a weird exceptional case. I think it inverts the relationship between those two. And I think it's philosophically problematic because, like, even the main argument about the halacha trying to preserve freedom of choice through not upholding contracts is not a sound argument because they don't give us a clear enough conception of what their sense of free choice is and why allowing people to not bind themselves to contracts upholds free choice as opposed to destroying it. And they're just not clear about this important distinction between the halacha imposing obligations and the halacha enforcing performance. Right? So I think there's just all these errors are here. So it's really Akasha and Yoni who enjoyed reading this article in the beginning of this month.
Wow.
Yeah. Anybody else have... Yakir, what do you think? What's your sense of the article here?
As a whole?
Yeah.
I think I somewhat agree with you here that I'm confused, like what framework I should be thinking of it in. To some extent, like, doesn't really...
I lost you for a second. Did everybody else lose Yakir for a second?
I lost. You got a little choppy.
Yeah, you got choppy. You say that again, Yakir?
I think we lost Yakir.
Yeah, we lost Yakir for a second. It's because he was trying to be too sympathetic to the article, so Zoom kicked him off. We lost.
Is that what you do with people who disagree with you, Itamar?
No, I didn't. It was Zoom. It was Maccabi De Shemayim. So let me just wrap up here with a few other.
He's back.
Oh, Yakir, you're back. We lost you for a second. Sorry, we lost you. We lost you. You went choppy, and then Zoom kicked you off for being too sympathetic to the article. You want to take another shot at your thing so we could hear you?
I have to revise my stance.
That's right. Can you just tell us one more time because you became too choppy at one point.
Yeah, no, I was saying I agree with you here that I'm confused, like, what framework I should be reading this article in. I think we've at least demonstrated pretty convincingly that it does not belong in conversation with our analysis of the sugya. I'm not sure what to take from that. Like, for example, like the last point about like the damages really being based in Nizikin with a presumption that it's the same amount. It's a nice fiddish. Like, I think you're right that it's like very much like it only works in the right with a real minority of Shitos and Sugya for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. We agree with you, Yakir. Okay, you went a little choppy at the very end, but we.
Yeah, sorry, something with my internet connection, I think.
Okay, let me just wrap up here again. Let me just make a few closing comments on this. So then the article talks about partnership agreements. We had seen this in the beginning of the year, where the Rambam seems to say that it's very difficult to make a partnership kinyan because all devar shlo bali olam. We saw the Ravid disagreed. They say the Shulchan Aruch rules like the Rambam, and they think this, again, is like a contradiction to the halacha upholding contracts. because it won't allow you to enter into a partnership contract. But then they say, oh, admittedly, the Ramah cites authorities who do endorse mechanisms for creating binding partnerships to engage in businesses in business that is not yet subject to a formal conveyance. So, you know, they kind of say, oh, look, the Rambam is the halachic rule, right? They say, look, in the same vein that the halacha doesn't uphold contracts in general, Maimonides rules that partnership agreements involving futures are not binding. And like, oh, admittedly, the Ramah disagrees. So it's hard to know why they kind of like portray like the rule as like non-recognition and all these other shittas as exceptions. Yoni. Yoni, I'm trying to unmute you, but...
Yeah, sorry. I also thought, honestly, the biggest surprise to me in this article was that if you're going to make an argument that a Poel and or Pavel and whatever, you know, whatever exactly he's talking about is, has this principle of Chuli B'nei Shel Avadim V'lo Avadim Lo Avadim, and that's like the whole basis, I'm surprised how much he didn't talk about the proofs to that idea. Like, there is a certain strand of Achronim who have a very strong view that there is a big difference between a Poel and an Evet. He doesn't quote them. Why didn't he quote any of the shittos about being sick?
Right.
Or any of the shittos about the limitation of 3 years?
Right.
Or like any of the discussion about like Gufo love Kanoehu? He doesn't quote any of that. And that's like the big proof to his whole concept.
Right, right. Yeah. I think he should have like really pumped the idea that Kili B'nei Yisrael, like the Yushalmi idea, you know, Yisrael Einam Konin Zemizeh, that, and like that, the strain and the Achronim that run with that idea would have been much better. But also notice, Yoni, he doesn't even talk about Avadim, right? You talk about this whole thing about the halacha doesn't allow contracts because it doesn't like compulsion. The halacha recognizes a category of Eved Ivri of Mocher Atzmo. So how do you reconcile this whole piece with the halacha allowing Jews to sell themselves into 6 years of indentured servitude? Right? I mean, isn't that like the elephant sitting in the room that should have to be addressed by an article like this, Yoni?
Yeah, I mean, he might just like concede it might be bi'isser, it's not fully permissible, it's not knowing this, not a zest, it's not relevant.
Ah, okay.
I think it's a big lack, but like, I think the fact is like, he should have to address it, but even beyond that, like, forgetting he was addressing a major criteria, like, he's just missing all the best proofs. Like, he's just not dealing with like his case as well as he should be.
Yeah. Yeah. Yair or Yakir, do you think it's problematic that he omits a discussion of Eved Ivri Mocher Atzmo?
No, not really.
You don't think that's like a clear example where the halacha allows you to undertake obligations that are, you know, like avdos and servitude and...
No, I'm not sure why, but it doesn't rub me the wrong way.
Okay. Yakir?
Yeah, I think it's somewhat problematic. It also seems very removed from the categories they're talking about. But the point they're making is broad enough that I think in the end it does seem problematic.
That they left it out, yeah. That's my sense in reading it.
The issue is that the argument they're making is so broad.
Yes.
And the area of halacha they're looking at is still pretty broad, but narrower than that argument.
Exactly. As Yoni pointed out last week, they're willing to. I agree with that. As Yoni pointed out last week, they're willing to dip into kinyanim of davar shelo bal yolam to prove that the halacha is reticent to enforce contracts, but they're not willing to dip into eved to show that the halacha is more than happy to. So if they were just focusing on schiras poalim narrowly, fine. But given that this is like a huge chulent of like the halacha's theory on free choice and enforcement of obligations, like it's hard for me, it's difficult to understand why Eved is not a natural place to look, especially, and this is the flip side of Yoni's point, that we've seen so many analytic connections between Eved and Poel. And even this article taps into avadim v'lo avadim l'avadim. And so, you know, you have to say something about avadim itself at some point, but they don't. Towards the end of the article, they want to say that, look, classical halacha is against contracts. They say, as mentioned earlier, major halakha authorities, Tur, Shulchan Aruch, endorse the positions about not selling that which one does not own, eviscerating the basis of what would eventually become modern contract law. Again, why they choose Ein Adam Makna Devar Shelo B'Li'olam as the halacha's authoritative position of being anti-contract and not the standard case of Schiras Poalim with a Kenyan as being the paradigmatic halachic statement on being pro-contract is a mystery to me. They say, however, beginning in the 13th century, many Jewish authorities found it possible to also accept the ruling that a person could indeed obligate himself to sell property he would later acquire by reconceptualizing sales according to the debt paradigm. So this is true. The Sefer HaTrumos has this idea, and it gets picked up by the Shulchan Aruch, that you can't, even if you can't sell something you don't yet own, you could be mischayiv yourself, like under this idea, almost like mitam arev, or just mitam hischayvos, that I owe you something, to be makna something. I could say like, oh, I'm creating a shibud in this property right now that I'm going to give something to you, and if I don't, you could collect this amount of money from me. Similar like we saw in the Ritva on the Chi of Mitam Arev, yes, there's no Chi of Nezikin if I say I'm going to go buy wine for you in Zol Shafat and I don't end up buying it, but if I say I'm mischayiv myself such that if I don't bring you wine from Zol Shafat, I'll pay you the equivalent in money, then of course I could undergo that kind of hischayivus. So I think actually this idea that he's about to point in the Sefer HaTrumos really just is the same idea of the Ravid, the same idea of the Ritva, that you could have his chayvos mitam arev. You could voluntarily obligate yourself in any sort of way that you want. He says, oh, this is makes its first appearance in a relatively obscure, virtually out-of-print medieval work by Reb Shmuel Hasardi, the Sefer HaTrumos. I just want to say that the Sefer HaTrumos is like one of the greatest and most prominent poskim in Choshen Mishpat. I mean, if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, you can't move in Choshen Mishpat without the Sefer HaTrumos. I mean, he's a contemporary of the Ramban. The Ramban had several tshuvos, the Sefer HaTrumos. I mean, if you look in Shulchan Aruch, he's all over the place. So I think to paint this shita that's going to revive expectancy remedies and the ability to contract and things shelo bal yolam through a mechanism of hischayvos and say, oh, it's this one wacko shita out there that's relatively obscure and virtually out of print is just not fair. Okay, so I wanted to get that point out. But then, of course, you know, even the Shulchan Aruch adopts this idea of the Sefer HaTrumos that says, yes, I can't sell you chitim shelo bal yolam. So if I say, Yakir, I'm selling you today the chitim that I will get, that's not valid. But if I'm mischayiv myself today to be liable for selling you stuff in the future, that present hischayvus could be valid. So, you know, I think it's wrong for them to kind of see this as like a modern development of halacha as opposed to just like a nice application of a principle of hischayvus rather than principles of property transfer. Okay. I'm really going to conclude by making some final observations on their philosophical reflection at the end of the piece. So they say, yes, this idea of hischayvos brings halacha closer to the common law. They do say, however, it's significant that while common law developed contract by turning away from monetary debt and towards notion of personal duty to perform, Jewish law instead revisited and broadened its conceptions of debt while remaining uncomfortable with the notion of one person or entity being empowered under civil law to compel another person to perform a particular service or conduct a future transaction. Notice the conflation again of the obligation to perform with the ability to compel performance. They say, oh, common law, unlike halacha, developed a notion of a personal duty to perform, whereas Jewish law shies away from having one person empowered to compel another individual to perform. So again, there's an asymmetry here. They say the halacha shies away from compelling performance, the common law embraces personal obligation. They think those are like the same thing. Also, I don't understand here isn't this debt mechanism itself a kind of obligation of a personal duty? Like, through the debt, you're basically creating a duty to do something? Postgame talk about this all the time. Postgame say, if a husband says, this is the prenup, the early prenup issues, if a husband says, if I don't give you a get, I will pay you $1 million as a penalty, that Postgame think is a kind of like imposition of a personal obligation, which might be problematic. So again, I see how conceptually they're different. One is creating like a sanction for not performing, and one is creating a duty to actually perform. But I'm not sure that this kind of debt mechanism, he's saying the fact that the halacha structured contracts through his chayvus is a way of structuring them without creating a personal obligation to perform. And I'm just not sure if that conceptual distinction makes the practical difference that they need to make in order to show that the halacha is against personal obligations. Okay. They say the halacha does not conceptualize a contractor's obligation as a binding promise, which must be obeyed, unlike authorities of common law. Instead, halacha sees contractual promise as a creative way to measure or define monetary debt, but which need not be thought of as creating any actual personal obligation to convey a specific piece of future property or to perform any other particular action. See, I kind of disagree with this. I think it's an open question when I say that I'm going to go to Zulshafat and get the wine for you. And if I don't, I'll pay you the value of the wine. So they want to say that in such an instance, the halacha is okay with it because I'm not obligating myself to get wine. I'm just creating a penalty or a liability for not getting it. I don't think that's compelling. See, I think the halacha all along recognizes an obligation. It's just skeptical to award damages because of whatever issues there might be. But if there's hischaivus, then that's a way to intensify the personal obligation or add a sanction onto it. Do you guys have thoughts on this distinction they're making here? Whether this conceptual distinction solves the idea, or whether it justifies the conclusion that there isn't, the halacha is okay with it because there's no personal obligation? Yoni?
If to summarize his argument in like five words, it sounds like he's distinguishing between Shibud HaGuf and Shibud Nechasim.
Yeah, something like that.
And that debt based is all Shibud Nechasim, compelling someone to perform under contract would be Shibud HaGuf.
Yeah.
And so like there's a discussion of how much is Shibud Nechasim, how much is Shibud Nechasim so distinct from Shibud HaGuf at some point, like, the Nechasim are an Arev to you, they really are, going to compel you because you have to have property. But like, I think at least conceptually it makes sense to distinguish. I agree with you practically, I'm not sure if there's a big difference. But I guess in terms of like the overall point, it's kind of like a loop around.
Yeah. Let me push back a little bit, Yoni, because I would say that in this case, it seems to me that really the Shibud Nechasim is not separate from the Shibud HaGuf, right? So let's talk about it this way. There are really three different kinds of, let's call it, obligations here. There's a let's take the Zulshafat case. In my view, there's a Shibud HaGuf to buy the wine. They're denying that. They want to say there's no Shibud HaGuf to buy the wine, right? Right, Yoni?
Yeah.
Right? So they want to say when I'm a schayiv to pay the penalty, there's no Shibud HaGuf at all. All there is a Shibud Nechasim on the contingency that if I don't buy the wine, my Nechasim will be liable. I think that's how they want to spin it. I just want to point out that even if I accept their argument, there's no Shibud HaGuf to buy the wine, isn't there still a Shibud HaGuf to make a payment in the event that I don't buy the wine? So you're saying they want to say there's no Shibud HaGuf at all. All there is a Shibud Nechasim. I think it's more accurate to say that even if there's no Shibud HaGuf on purchasing the wine, there's still a Shibud HaGuf to make a payment from your Nechasim if you don't buy the wine. There's also a Shibud Nechasim that if I fail in my Shibud HaGuf to make payment, then the Bezin could go straight to my Nechasim. So I just don't understand why they think the halacha goes to such an extreme to avoid the Shibud HaGuf of having an obligation to buy the wine, but the halacha is perfectly fine with my generating an obligation to make payment in the event that I don't buy it. Do you see that, the distinction that I'm getting at?
Yeah, it seems like you're arguing that Shibud Nechasim in this case is really, a shibud on the goods to collect nechassim, and not just a shibud directly on the nechassim themselves.
That's right.
Independent.
That's right. And if their whole theory is that the halacha doesn't allow us to impose obligations on ourselves, why should it allow ourselves to be mischayev ourselves b'mamon for non-performance?
Right, but I think that they just conceded it that when you're mechayev, you're not mechayev yourself at all. You're really just creating a lien, like the, I mean, even like the seglers, they're putting a lien on your nechassim. Your nechassim are kind of independent.
Yeah, I think
kind of like putting your property on, you know, on the, you know, within like, it's thoughtful for like the property itself.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right that that's what they're thinking. I just don't think they're justified in thinking it. I think they're conflating the absence of a shibud aguf to go to Zolshafat and buy wine with the absence of a shibud aguf to make payment in the absence of going to Zolshafat. Right? They're thinking you could just go directly to the shibud nechassim thing without any antecedent shibud aguf to make the payment. Right? Whereas, why couldn't somebody push back and say that deprives people of the freedom of choice in the same way that going to Zolshafat deprives people of their freedom of choice? Are you sympathetic to that, guys? Yeah, Yair, Yakir, Yoni, what do you think?
I don't know. I feel like I have to know more about this Trumot, this Sefer Trumot, and like the outcrops of it, because you're seeming to really paint it all as like an extension or identical to Arev and to the Ritzvah and to this Zolshafat case. But I'm not sure. They don't conceive of it that way. They view it more as like just creating like a shibud on your nechassim independently.
Yeah.
And like, I'd have to see more in that sugya.
Right. Let's see. Here's their translation of the Sefer HaTrumos, right? They say, in such a case in which a person obligates himself with something which is not found at his place and is not in his position, in his possession, he is obligated. And even though, you know, the Makna Devar Solom, etc., if he uses the terminology of debt, he is able to obligate himself as much as he wants, even with something that is not in existence, and even with something that is not in his hand. So they don't flesh out more than that here. Like we find in the case of one who creates a lien for his debt on that which he will acquire. Yeah, he doesn't flesh out whether, I guess you're saying that we have to look closer to Sefer Chumas to see whether this kind of hischaivos would have an accompanying shibud aguf, right?
Yeah, I mean, the Sefer Trumos, and then I guess like the Shulchan Aruch Nosei Kelim who come afterwards, how they conceded it.
Yeah. Good. Yair, do you have final thoughts on this?
Does this debt paradigm, I don't recall that Broid uses this debt paradigm to explain any kind of contract in the sense of performance, like a work contract. Am I right about that?
Well, right, he doesn't. He doesn't talk about it in terms of a work contract. But my point here is that I think this is really the same idea that the Ritva is getting at on the idea of his chayvas mitam arev.
Right, so that's where I'll echo Yoni and say that it's worth looking at the formulations and seeing if that holds. It might or it might not.
Yeah.
In the context in which they're applying it, I am more sympathetic to their distinction. I think that when we're talking about, you know, limitations on personal freedom, I don't think they might say that, yes, it's a limitation on personal freedom to make you pay back a debt the same way it's a limitation on your personal freedom to tell you you can't steal from people. Like, there are obviously some limitations on personal freedom with which we're okay, but adding the duties been here in one's person, I think, is different. I am more sympathetic to that.
Okay. Yeah. No, I definitely acknowledge that there's a distinction between creating an obligation on yourself and creating a liability for not performance. I just don't know if that is enough to do the substantive work that they wanted to do here. Let me just note here that they say, a person cannot surrender ownership of his free choice to another mortal. There is a clear aversion to obligating people in this way. So I'll just say that it's interesting, because if we're not talking about compulsion of performance, we're just talking about creating obligations to perform, then you might think that it's not infringing on free choice in any way. A person still has free choice to not perform. They just would have to pay damages for non-performance. And that's just very close already to their debt paradigm, where, yeah, if I don't perform, I have a liability now to pay. Similarly here, you might just say that the halacha will say a person has an obligation to perform. We're not going to compel performance, but there's going to be some damages if you don't perform. Okay. That's the basic upshot of what I wanted to point out in this article. So a lot of it's just like a large scale disagreement with their conception of how the halacha fails to recognize contracts. I think the halacha actually does recognize contracts. I think schiras polim is going to be more of the rule, and in the makna davar shlo bo liolam is an exception. That's a halacha in transfer, not a halacha in contracts. And I think their particular analysis of our sugya is consistently riddled with errors throughout their analysis. Anybody have any final thoughts before we close this? And after Yontif, we'll pick up with the One Sugyas. Anybody have final observations on the article? No? Yoni, you're good?
I think so. I'm going to want to listen to the recording from last class. But,
I have to post it. And we should look back at the Sefer HaTrumos. Yair, any closing thoughts?
No.
Okay. Yakir, closing thoughts?
Nope, I think that was good.
Excellent. So thanks for bearing with me in our 2 days of going through this article. We'll pick up with the Ones Sugyas. I think it just makes sense to do everything after Yontif. Does that make sense? Instead of having one Chabura before Yontif. Now probably everyone's busy. Does that sound right? Good to you guys?
Yeah.
Great, excellent.
Could you do like a pass-up stuff you have? I don't want to make you compare if you don't have anything, but if you have, we can try like... Just pass off stuff.
Oh, that's an interesting idea. I'll send out an email and ask guys if they're interested. Yeah, we could definitely do a Pesach topic, like right before Pesach or something. But awesome. All right, Yashar Koach, everybody. Chag Kashev V'Sameach. Maybe if you're down in Philly, come visit, even with the travel restrictions. Probably no one's leaving. Is everyone staying put for Yontif?
Yeah.